from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
I think what we're seeing is a classic example of not really looking at history, but trying to fight a current battle through history.
Mm-hmm.
History's become a foil, if you will, as opposed to a honest, forthright effort to try to understand history for its own sake.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Dr. Matthew Spaulding, Vice President of Washington Operations and Dean of the Van Andel Graduate School of Government at Hillsdale in D.C. We talked at length with Dr. Spaulding about the Hillsdale College 1776 curriculum. We go further in depth with Dr. Spaulding on this week's program. Dr. Spaulding, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, Scott, and welcome to Washington, D.C.
Thank you. Yes, we're recording today, actually, in our Boyle studio at the Kirby Center in Washington, D.C. I haven't been here since pre-pandemic, so my first time since masks are mandated in various places.
Well, we've been here the whole time, and the school has not shut down. We have continued.
It's a beautiful place out here in Washington, and the studio's up here on the top floor. We talked today about the 1776 curriculum that Hillsdale has just released. Dr. Kathleen O'Toole was with us a little while ago to sort of give us the very basics on this, the week of release, and we might go a bit deeper with you today, but for those who maybe missed the initial conversation, what is this 1776 curriculum? How long has it been under development?
Well, I think the how long it's been under development is actually a quite long, long time. The college since 1844 has been teaching. So I think this really goes back to all of those roots. We've had our own K through 12 academy, I believe, for some decades now, and we've had charter schools, which we have now many, for quite a few years. So the curriculum has been underway, shall we say, long predates the current controversies, whether those are 1619 or 1776, whatever it might be. The immediate curriculum does come out in this moment for a particular reason, which was the 1776 report, and for full disclosure, I went on leave to be executive director of that and worked on the report. Called for a curriculum, honest, clear, accurate, historical curriculum. Well, Hillsdale had already been doing it. It was in the work. It was long in the plans. There are more things to come after this.
Mm-hmm.
But we packaged the particular parts of that curriculum that have to do with some aspects of history, and then essentially a civics curriculum. And that's what the 1776 curriculum is, which is available on the website and free to anybody who wants to use it. And that is what we put out just a couple of weeks ago.
Yep. So the 1776 curriculum, why 1776? This might be an obvious question, but tell us, why call it the 1776 curriculum?
There's both an immediate and a broader question to that. I suppose the immediate one is that right now there's a controversy, as hard as is to understand, about when was the beginning of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not merely, when did the first people come here, when did the first settlers come here, when was slavery introduced, which is a legitimate historical question. Our argument is that there's really no controversy about that. We can debate what the particulars are. But the nation begins with a document called the Declaration of Independence, which is when the colonies got together in a Continental Congress and issued a statement signed by all of them and sent to the king. That started a literal war with England, which ultimately led to our independence. That we think is that's a pretty good date to take as our beginning. And I would say the broader answer to that 1776 curriculum is that, our read on American history, and I think this kind of is an entree into this crux of why this is such a controversial question, and maybe what are some of the deeper things in this curriculum. But we take the position, which is essentially the position of Lincoln and the early civil rights movement, Martin Luther King, and the founders themselves, which is that what's different about America is that its beginning, i.e. 1776, which in particular means the statement of principle that began our nation, the Declaration of Independence, that actually is centrally important to the continuation of our nation. And our nation has been a playing out of those principles. And thus, that beginning point really does matter, not merely as a date, which is a factual occurrence that began the country, but really as an intellectual touchstone.
Putting aside for the moment some of the 1619 controversy, what differentiates the 1776 curriculum from what would be covered, taught in relatively standard, typical history curriculum?
It's similar to probably some good curriculum that's out there. And I don't think we claim that somehow we've invented something that's not been in a curriculum before. But it is true that what was not at all controversial relatively recently has become controversial. And we do hew to a traditional view of how these things should be looked at. Having said that, I think there are some things that differentiate the Hillsdale curriculum, which are extremely important. One is a very strong emphasis on original documents. And that really is a pedagogical question about how to teach these things. That is, I think, one of the problems with how history is looked at nowadays is we've oftentimes become caught up in current debates and what secondary sources say, and we think it's actually more important to try to understand history as history itself. And so the best way to understand the founders, this defined group of what we call the founders or the framers of the Constitution, is actually see what they said. What did they think? What were they doing? What were the actual things that happened? So there's a very intentional emphasis on that, and because of that, there's a strong emphasis on getting at the principles of what they were doing. What did they intend? What were they trying to achieve? And then we look at what they actually achieved in light of that.
Talking with Dr. Matthew Spaulding here about the 1776 curriculum on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. You alluded to this earlier. I just want to dig a bit deeper about the importance of understanding the founding and doing it in the right way, because what has come since then is this continuation, this playing out of what happened back in 1776. Talk about that for a bit. Why is it so important to get this original stuff right?
Well, a part of that is, and here's a point I berate my students with when I begin my classes, and I think it's something we need to think about as we approach any historical question. We have a tendency to read history backwards. This is just a human proclivity, and we're seeing it really I think on steroids today. There's something going on today, a controversy or in our current case, a political debate going on, and we look backwards into history to find evidence of what we want to argue today. Well, that's shall we say, an illegitimate use of history. It's happened before. It'll happen again. We're seeing it happening now, I think, in a way that suggests that the current debate is really not a debate about history at all. Mm-hmm. We're fighting ideological battles. The proper way to understand history is to try to understand the history itself. So you go back and you study a Lincoln or the founders or whatever the question. You want to go to that thing. And you have an obligation as a student of history or just as someone who just wants to understand the history itself. You have an obligation to try to get the facts right as best you can, but also you have an obligation to the actors, the founders, a Lincoln, a Martin Luther King, whatever it might be, to try to understand it as they understood it. Now, you might disagree with them, but our first obligation is to try to understand it as they understood it. And that seems to be an honest and accurate way to look at history. And I think that's crucially important.
Dr. Spaulding, hold on there. We'll come back and talk more in depth about the 1776 curriculum from Hillsdale College. Find more at k12.hillsdale.edu. Click on the curriculum tab. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
When people ask me for a recommendation for a heating or air conditioning company, I always say Alliance Heating and Air. Why? Well, they've been taking care of our HVAC system for 14 years. Professional, friendly, and willing to go to the extra step for their customers. I have found no problem too difficult or too minor for them to repair. I recommend Alliance Heating and Air with no reservations. You can reach them at 530-221-2642 or online at homecomfort.org. And they have 24/7 emergency assistance. Alliance Heating and Air.
Premier, your friendly oil change. Premier in all we do.
Summer is upon us, and we all know what that means. Lots of summertime fun. Spend at the lake, by the pool, or off on adventures to your favorite waterfall or floating down the river. Servicing your vehicle is last on the list, but we all know it has to be done. Let Premier Oil Change save you time and money with their easy drive-in service. No appointment needed. Wait in the comfort of your own car, enjoy a cold beverage, and before you know it, you'll be off to your next summertime adventure, knowing that your car is summertime ready. Earn reward points for every dollar you spend, which can be redeemed for an oil change, additional services, and other great rewards. With free fluid top-offs, free check engine light inspections, free Wi-Fi, and a free car wash, you are sure to leave refreshed. Stop into a Premier Oil Change near you today. Visit them in Palisadro in the Holiday Shopping Center or in Redding on Lake Boulevard near Waterworks Park. And don't forget Anderson across from Round Table Pizza. Premier Oil Change, home of the friendly oil change.
Jazz up your weekend breakfast or brunch at Black Bear Diner with a sparkling mimosa made with our fresh-squeezed orange juice and Prosecco. It's a delicious and refreshing sidekick to your favorite omelet, Benedict, or pancake breakfast. At lunch or dinner, add a glass of red or white Kendall Jackson family wine, or choose a domestic, import, or specialty beer to ride along with your favorite entree. Serve daily at Black Bear Diner, 2605 Hilltop Drive.
Black Bear Diner.
Simpson University for Seniors, now in its 12th year, is offering two classes in September for adults of any age interested in learning. Early registration is encouraged. Classes start September 8th. Larry Porta will present a course on the most hated president in American history called The Life of Andrew Johnson. Professor Timothy Orr will teach a course on the history of Islam and its expansion entitled Of Caliphs and Kings. Classes meet from 10:20 to 11:20 a.m. and 11:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays on Simpson University's campus. The cost is $95 per person per course or $145 for couples registering for the same course. For more information, email gschafer@simpsonu.edu or call 530-226-4602. Simpson University is located at 2211 College View Drive in Reading.
Hi, this is Dr. Patricia Bay, and my radio show, Therapy in a Nutshell, which airs on Saturdays at 11 a.m. on KCNR 1460 a.m. or 96.5 FM, is a great show for you to listen to and learn how to effectively change your life. We talk about issues such as communication and trust, couples issues, and many more. Also, you can listen to the radio show on my podcast through the Anchor app, which is free and safe. Or you can tune into the iTunes or Spotify podcast and listen to it there. It's a nice show that'll help you throughout the day and throughout your life. So join me for Therapy in a Nutshell, Saturdays, 11 a.m. at KCNR Radio. This is Dr. Patricia Bay, trying to heal the world 1 hour at a time.
You get me every time.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We've been talking with Dr. Matthew Spaulding, Vice President of Washington Operations and Dean of the Van Andel Graduate School of Government at Hillsdale in D.C. about the 1776 curriculum from Hillsdale College. Dr. Spaulding, before the break, we were talking about the importance of getting the facts right and the importance of understanding history itself as you attempt to teach history to others. How do we take that knowledge and apply it to our current situation today?
I don't think that we're seeing a debate between two different ways of looking at history. I think what we're seeing is a classic example of not really looking at history, but trying to fight a current battle through history.
Mm-hmm.
History has become a foil, if you will, as opposed to a an honest, forthright effort to try to understand history for its own sake. And when I say that, I mean, when I say for its own sake, I mean, you know, warts and all, right? I mean, there are good parts of history, there are bad parts of history, but we should try to understand all of it. And then what's especially unique about American history, which is why we come back to this question about 1776 and the Declaration of Independence, is that unlike most countries, which merely come into being, America really does have a starting point at mm-hmm. which, and they said, here are the principles upon which we are going to operate going forward. Well, we ought to hold them to that. This is why Martin Luther King called the Declaration a promissory note. Why Lincoln looked at the Declaration when he was trying to solve the problem of slavery in the Civil War. American history is really a statement of a principle, and then that principle in history kind of playing itself out, which means how you look at the history at any particular time really should be in light of that principle. And that helps us make a distinction between what is a unacceptable compromise, something that's clearly wrong in light of those principles, but also a reasonable principle, a reasonable compromise based on a deliberate and reasonable and acceptable understanding of the situation at hand. That helps us get into those nuances. And again, another problem we tend to have today is if something is imperfect, we tend to either throw it all out or whitewash it. We think neither one of those is acceptable. Good, honest history should look at all of history, warts and all, and look at the idea of it, the principles, and how it was understood at the time, and then how it was carried out in history itself.
You have a copy of the curriculum over there. Give our listeners maybe some specifics on the sort of things that students who are undertaking the 1776 curriculum will be looking at.
Well, we alluded to earlier the fact that Hillsdale's been involved in curriculum for quite some time, and there's more in the future plans. Mm-hmm. There's the idea is imagine a much larger curriculum that covers a lot of other areas. The particular one we have now covers some slices of history, and then a bunch of things that fall broadly into this category of civics.
Mm-hmm.
And in history, it focuses on units dealing with the founding, which is this period from 1763 to 1789, so the kind of the end of the French and Indian War, the American Revolution, the Declaration, up to the Constitution, and then the Civil War. Those two pieces are especially right now something we think needs to be understood. So we have units that deal with the founding of the Civil War for kindergarten and second grade, third grade, fifth grade, middle school, and then high school. But then we have a whole series of units. I think there are eight or nine that deal with what we would consider to be civics, looking at again the ideas of the Declaration, the operations and the structure of the Constitution, how this plays out, how it was understood at the time, the separation of powers, all the things we associate with that. But then some of the debates over those ideas in history, whether it was during the Civil War, during the Progressive Movement, during the early Civil Rights Movement, how those institutions operate today. How current politics operates relative to those original institutions. Broadly speaking, what a student would need to know when it comes to civics, especially in terms of middle school and high school civics, mm-hmm. to be what we would say is a good citizen. It doesn't mean we give them their opinions. Doesn't mean they can't have policy disagreements. That's fine. But there are certain things you need to know about the structure of the government, how it works. For each one of those units, we then break it down into the various components a teacher would actually need. Talk about the objectives of the unit, how a teacher should prepare, what the contents of the lessons are. There's some stories. There are a series of questions. There's discussions about what are the keys to this lesson. There are quizzes. So each unit then is broken down into the particular lessons of that unit, but also all the different parts that a teacher would need to actually teach it. So it actually is we kind of throw this word curriculum around pretty easily nowadays, but it actually is an actual curriculum of the substance the teacher would need in the classroom and homeschool environment to actually teach all these units.
And you can find it at k12.hillsdale.edu. Click on the curriculum tab and you'll see it there, the 1776 curriculum. I had mentioned earlier in the conversation, put aside controversy for a minute as we talked. So let's bring it back. The 1619 project, there is a 1619 curriculum that has been adopted in some school districts across the country. Is this a direct response to that? And or is this a correction to what they're trying to accomplish?
Mm. I think the answer is no, but it is definitely a contribution to this debate. I mean, the claims of the 1619 project, which again, in many ways, I don't think are actual historical claims. This is a current fight that's going on, and they're using these arguments to get where they want to go. Having said that, there is and has long been from the very beginning, and there will be going forward, debates about what America means. This is what it means to be an American. You know, long before there was a 1619 project, during the antebellum period, there were debates about the status of the Declaration. And John C. Calhoun famously questioned its status and that it was wrong. It was an error. It was a flaw, which, by the way, is something we teach in our curriculum because that's an important aspect of understanding our history. There will continue to be these great challenges. So in that sense, we are contributing to an understanding of American history. But no, it is not a direct response to there are other curriculums out there.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them I think are just poorly done. Some of them I think are ideologically driven and are kind of teaching politics in the classroom. I think that's a problem and a mistake. What we really wanted to do was not respond to anything, but just have a good curriculum out there. It's one thing, and I and others to involve in debate about what we're against when it comes to curriculum and things in the classroom. We want there to be a good example, a model, an excellent model for others to look at and to emulate and to use of what a good curriculum should be in their classrooms, and that's why we created the 1776 curriculum.
Dr. Matthew Spaulding, Vice President of Washington Operations and Dean of the Van Andel Graduate School of Government at Hillsdale in D.C. You can also find the curriculum at k12.hillsdale.edu. Dr. Spaulding, thanks for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
Up next, Larry Elder is one of the leading Republican candidates in the upcoming California recall election. He joined us last year to talk about a film called Uncle Tom. We'll hear that again next. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Schools, families, and government leaders are finally on alert over teen vaping. But before we can solve it, we need to understand it. One, the draw is flavors. 97% of kids who vape use flavors. Two, kids often don't know they're vaping nicotine, let alone a concentrated formula. Three, nicotine's addictive, and it's also a neurotoxin that can increase teen anxiety. Nicotine is brain poison, and flavor is the hook. Do something at flavorshookkids.org.
Hi, this is Mark from Haven Humane Society. It has been a challenging couple of years, and through it all, our amazing team has continued to save lives. We have so many fantastic animals that are looking for their forever homes, and with adoption fees so low, now is the time to add to your family. With puppies, kittens, dogs, cats, and so many more, we have the perfect addition. Come join our team as a volunteer and help in an area that works for you. Walking dogs, socializing cats, helping in our veterinary hospital, or folding laundry. We have many opportunities and welcome all volunteers. For more information, please visit our website at havenhumane.org or follow us on Facebook. On behalf of the entire Haven team, thank you for all of your continued support as together we get closer every day to North State with no more homeless pets.
At the Wagner Law Group, their goal as a fire victims law firm is to advocate for those who have been victimized by Pacific Gas and Electric Company's negligence. The Wagner Law Group has been rated the number one fire attorney group in Northern California and has low contingency fees. So, if you or your loved ones have been affected by the Dixie or Zog fires, contact the Wagner Law Group today. Call 833-200-7111. That's 833-200-7111.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts, Wing Carpenter and Terry Raposa. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archives link.
ACA, come out and play. Have you seen the bill? We all have to pay. The time has come for 51. Jefferson State of Mind.
A Moment in History, brought to you by KCNR and historian Donnie Smith. The state of California made two identical historical markers for Bass Hill to honor the memories of the brave drivers who drove the stages and held the ribbons, or reins, on the dangerous California-Oregon stage road beginning in the 1850s. One marker was placed in Shasta and the other on the summit of Bass Hill, where the Pacific Highway, now Interstate 5, began its descent down to the Pitt River. The area of the Bass Hill marker was a favorite holdup spot in stagecoach days for legendary stagecoach robber Black Bart, who robbed three stages there. That marker has since been moved and is now located on the east side of the road leading to Bridge Bay Resort across from the guard shack. Black Bart was eventually caught and sentenced to prison in San Quentin for those, plus other stagecoach robberies. A Moment in History, brought to you by KCNR and historian Dottie Smith. Want to get more Dottie? Go to the Shasta County Historical Society.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. For information about Hillsdale College, for prospective students, for alumni, or friends of Hillsdale, head to hillsdale.edu. Larry Elder is an author, radio host, and executive producer of the recent film Uncle Tom, an oral history of the American black conservative. He's also one of the leading Republican candidates at this moment in the California recall election. We talked with Larry Elder last year about Uncle Tom. You can find more about that at UncleTom.com. We listen back to that conversation now.
Tell us first about the title and the phrase. Some people might not know. What is an Uncle Tom? Where does that phrase come from?
Well, the term Uncle Tom has become a term that means if you are black and you are perceived as having views that are antithetical with the best interests of black people, you are considered to be a sellout, a self-loather, an Uncle Tom, a coon, and names I can't say on family radio. It came from a book by Harriet Beecher Stowe that was written before the Civil War that made Northerners for the first time realize the brutality of slavery. Believe it or not, people in the North were kind of naive about it. Sure. So they read the book. It was a novel based upon real-life characters that Harriet Beecher Stowe, the author of the book, knew, especially and including Uncle Tom, the lead character, who was patterned after a slave named Josiah Hinton, a real-life man who was, as in the book, a hero. He duped the overlords into thinking that he was selling out when, in fact, he was allowing slaves to flee, and because he refused to tell where they were, he was ultimately killed. So the kind of bizarre thing is that Uncle Tom was really a hero, but when people use the term, they of course mean it to demean people. So it shows you they never read the book, or if they have, the term has become corrupted. But it really doesn't matter. The point is, people featured in the film, the conservatives featured in the film, Candace Owens, myself, a rapper named Kingface, a pastor named Broden, Carol Swain, who was a law professor at Vanderbilt, mm-hmm. Herman Cain, who, as you know, ran for president, Alan West, a former congressman. All of us have suffered the same fate, and that is to simply suggest that maybe, just maybe, our fate ought not rest in the hands of the Democratic Party. This is a party, after all, that is a party of porous borders. And there's a Harvard economist who says there's no question that there are winners and losers because of illegal immigration. One of the biggest losers are unskilled people living in the inner cities, black mm-hmm. and brown workers who have to compete for jobs that they might hold that are now held by illegal aliens and who also put downward pressure on their wages. Maybe we ought not be in the party of Roe v. Wade, 25% of abortions performed on black women. Mm-hmm. Maybe we ought not be in the party that mandates your child is going to go to an underperforming government school whether you like it or not. When people like myself and the others in the movie raise these issues, because all of us feel this way about school choice, instead of having a healthy debate about whether or not school choice would make things better, we're shut down, we're called Uncle Tom's, and the conversation is not held. I mean, hell, there are 13 Baltimore high schools, public Baltimore high schools, where 0% of the kids can do math at grade level, and there's another half a dozen where just 1% can. That's almost 50% of all the public high schools in Baltimore, yet we're not having a serious discussion about empowering parents to opt out of schools like that? Are you kidding me? And so all I'm asking in this film is, can we have a reasoned discussion, a fact-based discussion with people you disagree with without one side being dismissed and maligned as Uncle Tom's?
And that's the core, as you say. The core question here is, shouldn't all Americans, every American, simply have a right to his or her own opinion, coming to an opinion based on the facts as he sees them?
Well, that's right. And one of the reasons I feel that the Democratic Party and the media have been so successful in creating this narrative that Democrats are the saviors and Republicans are racist, because the history of both parties is pretty unknown by many people, especially black people. If you've gone to a public high school, it is probably likely that you don't know Democrats were founded. One of their founding principles was to preserve slavery, and you might not know that the Republican founding principle was to stop the spread of it and eventually to eliminate it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are completely unaware that Democrats opposed the 13th Amendment that freed the slaves, 14th Amendment that gave the slaves citizenship, the 15th Amendment that at least on paper gave them the right to vote. And most people don't know, a lot of blacks don't know, that as a percentage of the party, more Republicans supported the Civil Rights Act, around 80% in the House and in the Senate, versus the Democrats, around 60% in the House and the Senate. And then there's this notion that somehow they've been able to sell that in the mid-60s, after the passage of the Civil Rights Act, there was this big switch. The racists left the Democratic Party, and the racists became racist Republicans. The problem with that aside, it's just not true. It's easy to refute. You look at all the Democrats who voted against the Civil Rights Act of 64 in the Senate, and all of them who voted against it in the House, and you have to ask yourself, how many of them switched to become Republicans? Answer: one in the Senate, Strom Thurmond, one in the House whose name I can't even remember. The fact is that these Democrats were raised Democrats in the South, died Democrats. Al Gore's dad was one of the Democrats that led the longest filibuster in the history of Congress to prevent the bill from even coming on the floor. And a lot of people are unaware that but for people like Everett Dirksen, the Republican senator from Illinois who got an award from the NAACP for helping to navigate this thing through, but for people in the House like Bob McCullough, a Michigan Republican who got a handwritten note from Jackie Kennedy when he retired, thanking him for his work to help realize her husband's goal of passing a Civil Rights Act.
Larry Elder is with us, executive producer of the new film Uncle Tom. You can find out more at UncleTom.com. Larry, we've all heard this about Clarence Thomas. He doesn't count, right? He's not black anymore. There's a prominent columnist that I've read for a while in Chicago, and she's written multiple columns, one about Omarosa when she was in the Trump administration, one about Ben Carson, that they have turned in their black cards for what they believe and how they have served. How do they get away with this? Get away with it? How do they get wiped away for an opinion?
It's pretty disgusting, isn't it? There's a prominent magazine. It's not doesn't have the same power and clout that it used to have, but Ebony Magazine, clearly the most prominent black magazine for decades. Every black household had a copy of it sitting on the coffee table. And every year they had a feature called the 100 Most Influential Black Americans, Scott. And every year, absent from that list are Clarence Thomas, even though he's one of nine members of the Supreme Court and by definition is influential, not in there. Tom Sowell, author of something like 56, 57 books, I've lost count.
Mm-hmm.
David Mamet referred to Thomas Sowell as America's, quote, greatest contemporary philosopher, close quote, and credits him from helping to turn Mamet from being a, quote, brain-dead liberal, close quote, into being a more thoughtful person.
Mm-hmm.
Walter Williams is not in the in the list of the 100 most influential black Americans. Walter Williams is an economist. He's had a newspaper column for decades. It's in over 150 newspapers. He's written about 20 or 30 books, and to my knowledge, is the only black man ever to head up the economics department of a non-black college or university. Yet many black people are completely unaware of who these gentlemen are because the black media shuns them. It's outrageous we can't have a discussion in the black community about things like school choice, about things like abortion, about things like porous borders, about things like job-killing measures like minimum wage, without anybody raising these questions, being called an Uncle Tom, and being dismissed. It's ridiculous.
In the film Uncle Tom at UncleTom.com, there are not just names you know, there are names you will not know. Ministers, veterans, a self-employed plumber. Why is it important to turn the attention on not just people in media as yourself, but everyday Americans who are dealing with this?
Well, Scott, I wanted the movie to be relatable to everybody. And I didn't want it to be a bunch of eggheads, a bunch of Ivy League people kicking back, talking about, here are the facts, here are the facts, here are the facts. I wanted to talk about this on a real level where people could relate. And the real soul, heart and soul of this film is none of the persons that I just now mentioned, is a young man named Chad Jackson. Chad
mm-hmm.
Jackson is a contractor, has his own business in Texas. He's not a politician. He doesn't have sharp elbows. He's a sweet, sensitive guy who is a lifelong Democratic Christian. And one of his fellow Christians approached him once because Chad had said some negative things about the Republican Party and said, have you read both party platforms? He said, no. He said, I challenge you to read the Democratic Party platform and Republican Party platform, and you tell me what you are. And so Chad did it. And after he read both platforms, he said, I'm a Republican. And the grief he got from friends and family. We didn't even put in the film, Scott, a conversation he had with his own mother, where when he tried to tell her why the police were, quote, disproportionately killing black people by informing her that a young black man is 8 to 10 times more likely to be a victim of a homicide, and almost always the perpetrator is another young black man. That's why the cops are there.
Yeah.
When he told her this, she said, you're part of the problem. You're putting the black man down. And he said, Mom, if you don't acknowledge the facts, we're never going to be able to figure out what to do about it. I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to hear about this. You're now being manipulated by people telling you to put the black man down. His own mother!
That's Larry Elder, one of the leading Republican candidates in the upcoming California recall election. He's also the executive producer of Uncle Tom, an oral history of the American black conservative. The conversation from last year here on this program. Up next, we talk with Blake McAllister from Hillsdale's Philosophy Department about understanding moral disagreement. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Explore your world right from home with Turtle Bay TV.
Daintree is a jungle carpet python.
Featuring free educational and distance learning content for a virtual experience the whole family will enjoy.
Welcome to the vault.
Start streaming now at turtlebay.org.
Founded in 1995, GI Pathology is the only physician-owned laboratory in the United States dedicated solely to the practice of gastrointestinal and liver pathology. The company provides the highest quality GI pathology diagnosis made exclusively by one of our fellowship-trained gastrointestinal and liver pathologists. GI Pathology delivers results to its Northern California client base within an industry-leading 24 hours. Call 888-2-GI-PATH or go to www.gipath.com for more information.
Over for savings at Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market and Eureka Way next to Dutch Bros in downtown Reading. Buy 5 car wash coupons and get one free. Or buy 10 and get 3 free. Quick and Clean is a family-owned business. They offer only the highest quality service. Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market and Eureka Way next to Dutch Bros in downtown Reading. Quick and Clean.
Have you been putting off getting your colonoscopy due to COVID restrictions? Well, there's no better time than now. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, colorectal cancer screenings have declined by 86%, and as a result, up to 10,000 more deaths are projected over the next decade. With early detection, colon cancer has a 90% survival rate, and it may even be preventable with a colonoscopy. At Reading Endoscopy Center, our number one priority is the health and safety of our patients, and our center has always been committed to maintaining strict infection control and prevention protocols. Schedule your colonoscopy today by calling us at 530-246-7000 or visiting readingendoscopy.com. Visit readingendoscopy.com.
Hi, this is Matt. I'm your host of Liberty Unabashed, a new show on Sundays 8 to 9. We're going to have some good music, some deep thought, and I hope you check us out.
There's more to explore with a Turtle Bay membership. Get unlimited access to world-class exhibits, exciting animal shows, towering playgrounds, and beyond. Family memberships are only $90 a year. That's less than $8 a month for a whole year of fun. Join today at turtlebay.org.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Find older editions of the program and also sign up to get an email every time there's a new episode. Go to radiohour.hillsdale.edu. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined by Dr. Blake McAllister, Assistant Professor of Philosophy at Hillsdale College. Dr. McAllister, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here, Scott.
Talking with you today about some research and some writings you've done on understanding moral disagreement. Having read some of the work here, it seems to have the intent, at least in part, of bridging a gap between two sides. Is that right?
I think that's fair to say. Though I'm definitely coming at it from the Christian side and speaking specifically to Christians. But I want Christians to realize why it is that others might disagree with them, with us, and why those people may not actually be irrational in doing so.
So can there be reasonable moral disagreements?
I think so, yes. Certainly many non-Christians are irrational, as are some Christians, if we're being frank. But there are at least some adherents of the opposing positions that seem to be weighing the evidence available to them just as diligently and competently as any Christian is.
Mm-hmm.
The beliefs of such people, I think, are irrational. Now keep in mind here, by reasonable or rational, that doesn't mean that everything's going all right, epistemically speaking or morally speaking. Being unreasonable, or what's more often called irrational, is a particular sort of accusation, and it says that you're not weighing the evidence correctly. That is, given the information available to you, you're not following where the evidence leads. You've made some mistake.
In your writings, people can find, do a Google search, Understanding Moral Disagreement, you describe this framework that you call Seeming's Foundationalism. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, we like jargon in philosophy. It makes us seem smarter than we actually are. So I'll break Seeming's Foundationalism into two bits. There's starting with the foundationalism bit. So going all the way back to Aristotle, there's a very famous argument called the regress argument, that not everything can be justified by arguments.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Well, because let's say I give you an argument for a conclusion. That argument's going to have premises. Why should you believe those premises to be true? I suppose I could give you another argument for the premises, but that's going to have its own premises. And so you can see how this leads to a regress. And eventually what has to happen, it seems, is that we have to come back to first principles,
mm-hmm.
foundational beliefs that are justified immediately, not on the basis of any kind of argument. Well, what is it that justifies those foundational beliefs? The traditional answer is experience, that those beliefs are immediately justified on the basis of some kind of experience of the world. Now, I've described those as appearances. And in fact, that's actually very close to the answer that Aristotle himself gives.
Mm-hmm.
He says that we start with how things appear, and then we reason from there. So on this framework, then, of Seeming's foundationalism, or appearance foundationalism, being rational is about believing in accordance with the appearances.
So I can perhaps hear some of our listeners asking the question, does that mean, does this make being rational too easy? Can anyone just believe anything that appears true to them?
I hope not. I mean, I see the worry, though. For instance, if I look around and say, well, the Earth seems flat to me, am I therefore justified in believing that the Earth is flat? Well, one thing to note here is that appearances really only serve as your starting points.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that that's where you're going to ultimately end up. The way that philosophers describe this is that appearances provide prima facie justification. I mean, you're justified until reason for doubt arises. Effectively, this is a kind of presumption of innocence. You're mm-hmm. innocent until proven guilty. So you can't just say, well, it appears to me this way, so it must be true. You've got to see whether that fits with all of your other appearances. And in the flat Earth case, we have all sorts of other evidence that tells us not to trust the flat Earth appearance. That being said, rationality can be easy in certain moments, but I think that's precisely right. Children are rational when they look and it seems that their mother is there, and they form the belief, there's mommy.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be hard. One last point on the flat Earth. Notice that when humans first looked around them, and it seemed that the Earth was flat to them, they probably were perfectly reasonable in believing that the Earth was flat. Why? Because they didn't have the same evidence available to them that we have today. So beliefs that can look crazy to us and are crazy based on the evidence available to us may not have been crazy given a different set of evidence.
Now, perhaps others are saying some of this explanation maybe sounds a bit like relativism. Is it?
Not at all. So first of all, the mere existence of reasonable disagreement. You know, if you fervently believe one thing and I fervently believe another, and we're both reasonable in holding those convictions, that doesn't mean that there's no objectively true answer there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you're right and I'm wrong. This becomes especially apparent if you look at disagreements across history.
Does perspectivalism eliminate the possibility of fruitful dialogue between Christians and non-Christians?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't think it does, although it does show that finding a way to have fruitful dialogue is sometimes more challenging than we'd like mm-hmm. it to be. For one, our basic stock of appearances, including a lot of our moral intuitions about the world, are going to be largely the same. And we shouldn't overemphasize the extent of the disagreement between Christians and non-Christians. And this is, I think, because of our shared human nature. We all have the same basic kinds of rational faculties, and although those faculties can be warped, their deliverances can be obfuscated by a variety of cultural factors, maybe suppression of truth in wickedness, as Paul mentions in Romans 1. But it remains the case, nonetheless, that there are at least a lot of common intuitions that we can appeal to in arguing with one another. The second thing is that you can also point out internal inconsistencies in someone's position. So mm-hmm. given the things that appear true to them, we can show that there's a certain tension in their view. Alas, neither of those two things will, I think, fully resolve all of our moral disagreements. But that seems right to me. Disagreement, especially moral disagreement, is to some degree ineliminable. For instance, if there's a fundamental disagreement between you and your interlocutor about some basic moral principle, if what seems self-evident to you is not self-evident to them, then there may not be any way for you to convince them of your point by traditional discursive argumentation.
Mm-hmm. How is this conversation about understanding moral disagreement relevant to the kind of liberal education that we hold dear here at Hillsdale?
It's a good question. I think there's a close relationship because, as I understand it, liberal education is not primarily about transmitting facts, you know, memorize these things,
right.
X, Y, and Z. What it is it's trying to initiate people into a way of seeing the world. It's trying to give them a particular kind of perspective. Now, I don't think that perspective is quite the same as the Christian's perspective, but it's certainly one that's consonant with it, harmonious with it, that naturally leads from one to the other. So that's certainly what I envision myself to be doing in the philosophy classroom, right? Is helping students to come to have a fundamental grasp of reality that allows them to see things as they really are.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this is the project, arguably, of philosophy since the beginning. Plato describes in The Republic education as a kind of turning of the eye away from the shadows and towards what's real.
Dr. Blake McAllister, Assistant Professor of Philosophy here at Hillsdale College, talking about understanding moral disagreement. Dr. McAllister, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. Matt Spaulding from Hillsdale in D.C. as we discussed more in depth the Hillsdale 1776 curriculum. Larry Elder, a Republican running in the upcoming California recall elections, joined us last year to discuss a film on which he was executive producer, Uncle Tom. We heard that conversation once again. And Blake McAllister from Hillsdale's Philosophy Department on Understanding Moral Disagreement. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. Search for The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Find the show on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio or on Facebook. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
You know, it can be difficult to find a trustworthy, knowledgeable, and yet affordable auto repair shop. Advanced Automotive is the second generation, locally owned, full-service repair shop serving our community since 1993, and one of only four AAA-approved auto repair shops in the Reading area. Advanced Automotive has a goal, and it's to keep it simple to have safe, reliable vehicles for our customers and our community. Call or come by to meet the crew who is here to serve you. 244-4423. Advanced Automotive.
Talent is cheaper than table salt. What separates the talented individual from the successful one is a lot of hard work. Stephen King.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Sorry if my sound sounds a little bit off today. I am unable to make it to the studio to do recordings for the first little bit in January. But happy 2021.
Yay!
We are starting a new year. We've got a new theme for you this month. And this month we are covering the Pearls from the Masters.
Each episode we're going to be covering a different master of the craft and different advice that they give. So if you really like the openers of every episode we've done so far, this month is for you because it's a lot of that.
So a lot of people will always go to one book in particular if they're learning how to write. And that book is On Writing by Stephen King. So our first master that we're going to cover this month is Stephen King. He is very good at what he does. There's a reason why he basically defined an entire genre.
I think most people are at least familiar with his work in some regard.
If you aren't, you probably at least know of works like It, Pet Sematary, Carrie. Those were all from the creations of Stephen King.
So if you missed our last episode, last Thursday was December 31st, the frequently asked question that we covered was, how do I learn? And we offered some questions about how to analyze advice and feedback. That is going to be our format going forward through this month. And those questions are, do I agree with the advice being given? What evidence do I have that supports or defies that advice?
Do I share a target audience with the person giving the advice? And why am I getting this advice? Are they preaching to the choir, or does this challenge my status quo?
And how much do I value this person's opinion?
And the final question is, why have they given said advice before?
So our opener started with, talent is cheaper than table salt. Do you agree?
I don't know if I agree with that one. I think mostly what I see is underdeveloped writers. Yes, there are people with some natural talent in writing, but I've also seen quite a few with natural talent that do nothing with it. So I think I do get what he's saying here, is if you have the talent and do nothing with it, it really doesn't matter, so it has the value of table salt.
And I think that kind of goes into the next quote. If you don't have time to read, you don't have the time or the tools to write. Simple as that.
This one is so important. I most definitely agree with this, and I know you do too, because you can't learn the instincts of writing without having read it.
This one I kind of feel like preaches to the choir a little bit, because people who don't read while they're writing aren't going to listen to this advice. I don't know of anybody who writes incredibly well that reads nothing.
Yeah, I agree with it. This one is definitely preaching to the choir, because if you aren't reading while you're trying to write, how much are you actually going to read advice in general?
Yeah, that's kind of true for all of the advice we're looking at.
So the next quote is, the road to hell is paved with adverbs. I know your opinion on this.
Yeah, it was about a year ago I very adamantly stated that I disagree with this one. I understand why it's said, but it's not actually adverbs that are the problem here. So, yes, this challenges my status quo. No, I do not agree with it whatsoever.
but are you willing to listen to it and try to apply it?
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.